featured composer is Thomas Luis de Victoria. This is BBC Radio 3. It's 7 o'clock, time to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for the first of this evening's proms. It's presented by Martin Handley.
Thank you very much indeed, Jill. Hello and welcome to the Royal Albert Hall. Well, this proms season has quite a focus on Brahms, not to mention the composer of the week we've just heard, but I think we can say the core of Brahms 2011 at the proms starts right here with the first of two concerts tonight and tomorrow, in which Emmanuel Ax plays both piano concertos with the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, who also deliver two symphonies. In charge is a man who's been conducting Brahms for more than 50 years and for whose music he has great empathy and love, Bernard Haitink. Now, when I was talking to him a couple of months ago, he told me how much he was looking forward to working with the COE, which celebrates its 30th anniversary this year. So what does the band think of Haitink? I asked their chairman, Peter Redman.
They adore Bernard. The reason for it is he allows them to play, he encourages them to play, and I think he enjoys listening to them. And I think it's a mutual thing that the orchestra feel very strongly that they're with a great musician and somebody who knows their Brahms backwards, forwards and sides and brings so much to them who don't know Brahms so well. So while they can play and are allowed to play and listen to each other, they've always got a very sharp eye on Bernard, who isn't making, as far as I can see, great gestures. He's basically just guiding, but he is overseeing the whole thing in the most magisterial way. And it's one of those relationships that has become very powerful. And the very fact that he's chosen to work with the Chamber Orchestra so much at this stage in his life is testament to how he feels about it.
Peter Redman, chairman of the Chamber Orchestra of Europe. Well, after the interval, we'll hear the young Brahms take his first tentative, but in the end enormous, symphonic steps in his first piano concerto. And it's a symphony which begins tonight's programme, his third, a work he was inspired to write by a visit he made to the Rhine, the same river that had prompted Schumann to compose his third symphony some three decades earlier. There's even a similar plunging rhythm at the start of both works, but Brahms precedes it with three opening chords, major, minor, major again, and their top notes F, A flat and F, Brahms' personal motto, standing for frei aber froh, free but happy. And that major-minor conflict seems to express Brahms's ambivalence to that idea and continues throughout what is his most concise and concentrated symphony, as though this is Brahms at 50 taking stock of his life. In which case, if the mood of the first movement harks back to the young, passionate composer, then the middle two are introspective, confiding and romantic as Brahms approaches middle age and finds his mature style. And the finale, then, is Brahms the master, dramatic and emotionally severe, the successor to Beethoven. Is this Brahms struggling with the thought of approaching old age? And the final return of the opening of the symphony is then perhaps the memory of youth, which casts a serene glow over the final pages. Well, as you can well imagine, it is an absolutely rammed, I think the expression would be, Royal Albert Hall tonight, very expectant. And I think the stage is just nicely full. It's a chamber orchestra, yes, but it's still 12 first violins, 12, 10, 8, 6, 4, so four double basses. It's just perfectly formed, you might say, for this horseshoe shape of the Royal Albert Hall platform. And from having heard rehearsal this morning, all I can say is that I think we're in for a complete treat. Well, the leader of the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, Marika Blankenstein, is already on the platform. She tuned the orchestra. Now here is Bernard Haitink to conduct Brahms' Third Symphony. resolving his musical conflicts, at least, in the serene, glowing ending to his third symphony, performed here in the Royal Albert Hall and live on Radio 3 to open this BBC Prom by the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, conducted by Bernard Haitink. Says he enjoys working with the COE partly because of the sheer quality of the players. So many are leading soloists, chamber musicians, they're leaders of other orchestras, the string players, partly because of the great love of chamber music in Brahms's day. The orchestras he conducted and wrote for had smaller string sections, less juggernautical, you might say, just like the Chamber Orchestra of Europe. Back comes Bernard Haitink, positively marching onto the platform. Needless to say, the score of Brahms 3, which was open before the performance, is still open at the first page. And the first horn, Chris Parks brought to his feet, together with the entire upper wind section and the strings. Well, he started listening to the Proms during the war, Bernard Haitink, as a boy in occupied Holland, and the Nazis tried to block transmissions. He said there was terrible reception, but one thing he particularly remembers was Ida Haendel playing the Brahms Violin Concerto. And the Proms ever since, I suspect, have meant a lot to him, and the Proms audience and the concentration of that audience. Still teaching new conductors, Bernard Haitink. He did a masterclass, I think several masterclasses, but he was in Lucerne in the spring. Seven lucky young conductors got to work with Bernard for 3 days. He said one of the things he was trying to teach was not to be in your own world, try to have more contact with the orchestra. Well, the contact he has with this orchestra is, I think, extraordinary. It's partly the way he inhabits the music. It all seems so natural. Well, after the interval here in the hall, the young Brahms manages to combine the most crucial musical and personal influences in a work of extraordinary emotional commitment, his first piano concerto, for which Bernard Haitink and the Chamber Orchestra of Europe will be joined by Emmanuel Ax. And for the next 20 minutes here on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms, we stay with Brahms as we head down to the Royal College of Music, where earlier this evening, Tom Service tried to discover more about the often misunderstood man behind the music.
Aimez-vous Brahms? Well, the title of François Sagan's novel is, I think, one we still have to consider. Do we today still love Brahms? Is he one of the pantheon of the three Bs, the others being Bach and Beethoven? Does he deserve that status up there with them? Or is he rather, as Pyotr Ilyich Tchaikovsky described him, a giftless... There's a word that Tchaikovsky uses there, which I can't really use at Radio 3 or in such esteemed company at this time, but you can imagine the rest. Well, with me to discuss and think about this still controversial composer here in the Amaryllis Fleming Concert Hall, the Royal College of Music, just over the road from the Royal Albert Hall, are the writer and broadcaster, Stephen Johnson, and the pianist and writer, Kenneth Hamilton. A round of applause, please. Stephen, turning to you first, do you think, as your article in this year's Proms Guide that many of you may have seen, that we're today slightly less in love, even maybe we've fallen out of love with Brahms?
I wonder about this. After all, he's enormously popular. He's one of the few composers that you can put on and be sure of an audience. At the same time, well, I wonder actually, as a quotation I'm enormously fond of by Hans Keller about Tchaikovsky, in the days when Tchaikovsky used to be sneered at much more than he is today, when Keller said that Tchaikovsky, who is loved by the genuine musician and amateur music lover alike, will always be sneered at by the intellectual equivalent of the nouveau riche. And I think there is a sort of There's a pose that some people adopt with regard to Brahms. The idea that if you want to show your progressivist credentials, you sneer at Brahms because he was so immured in the music of the past and so concerned with Beethovenian sonata form. Mm. And I think it's rather silly.
There is a good lineage there, isn't there? George Bernard Shaw called him a Leviathan maunderer. Benjamin Britten said, periodically I play through all of Brahms. Usually I've underestimated just how bad he is. More recently, composer Thomas Edis has said about Brahms, the one thing I can't forgive him for is his self-pity. But look, Kenneth Hamilton, the funny thing about our image of Brahms, it may be going along with what Stephen's saying, this rather fusty and musty sort of image, that beard, those clothes, all the iconography of Brahms, the old man. Who was the guy behind the beard, do you think?
Well, it's rather interesting. Nothing much of any interest happened in Brahms' life. He had a very boring life. He said so himself. He said he decided when he was 50 he would never get married and never write an opera, he said. And some of this image comes over even in his own lifetime. Liszt described Brahms as hygienic but not exciting, he said. of course, it was what he really sort of thought of the music. He said of one of the violin sonatas, he said, when I heard it first, I found it very boring, but then somebody told me it was a masterpiece, he said, very ironically. So he's supposed to like it then. Brahms hid from people. He was, I think, a very shy, a sensitive chap. You see these pictures of Brahms with the big beard, the sort of Old Testament style beard. There are also some slight contradictions here. One is that apparently from people who knew him, his voice was actually quite high pitched. Not quite a sort of Mickey Mouse-style speaking voice, but so you have this idea of the picture we see might well have been slightly different from what we would have heard had we heard Brahms actually speaking. There is one recording of Brahms, an Edison cylinder recording, and many people are not entirely sure whether the introduction to this, sort of here is Johannes Brahms, was actually spoken by Brahms or by the sound engineer at the time. But if it is Brahms, it is certainly quite a sort of high-pitched tenor.
Amazing.
Also must remember that most of the pictures we have of Brahms are of his very much in his later life. Yeah. And the descriptions of him are of somebody who was lean, extremely athletic. Yeah. Clara Schumann remembers him doing these extraordinary press-ups on top of the banisters. And with this rather dashing figure, a Listian figure.
What he looked like as a young man, the time when he meets Schumann, and Schumann describes him as a genius when he's in his early 20s. So, Stephen, what then about that central emotional, possibly physical relationship in his life, that relationship with Robert Schumann, relationship above all with Clara Schumann?
This is one of the fascinating things. I mean, Schumann is, in many ways, in most ways, perhaps the archetypal German romantic composer. He really is. And he is also the composer who turns up most regularly on a list of composers who are probable manic depressives. He was a man who, in his earlier forms, has an astonishingly lateral attitude towards musical form. In fact, you could say that one of the signs of Schumann's increasing instability in his later years is when he starts to panic about form and become rather more conservative in his attitude towards it. And this man adopted Johannes Brahms as his musical son, effectively. Mm. But I'm sure that the experience for Brahms of witnessing, almost within a year, Schumann becoming terminally insane, trying to kill himself in the Rhine, dying in the asylum at Endenich, I'm sure that left enormous scars on Brahms. And I'm sure also that it affected his attitude to musical form, to this whole question of how you provide a kind of container that's strong enough but elastic enough to contain powerful emotions.
It's something about those volcanic emotions that Brahms releases, maybe above all in his early music, especially music like the First Piano Concerto, Kenneth. I mean, we get the sense in music like that. He is a young man dealing with volcanic emotions, loves, passions, desires, the opposite of the hygienic sort of thing that Liszt is on about. So, I mean, where do those emotions come from? How do they play out in his music and in his life? Maybe even that relationship with Clara Schumann.
This is great. In my view, the Schumanns did an awful lot of harm to Brahms in two ways. One of them he admitted himself. I mean, as Tom and Stephen say, Schumann writes this article in the early 1850s called Neue Bahnen, New Paths, where he says, I've just met this young chap, Johannes Brahms, and he is the future of music. He is the new path of German music. German music, not sort of any other sort of, it's very specifically German. So Brahms is supposed to...
Quite a lot of pressure, right?
Yes, it's a lot of pressure. And Brahms himself admitted later on that he's sort of, well, I suppose the modern modern terms, freaked out about this, because here you have Schumann, by this time a very celebrated composer. You have Liszt in his school in Weimar wanting to be the new German school. They were eventually described the new German school. And then Schumann saying, no, if this chap Brahms is going to be the new German school. And Brahms is still in his 20s. He's very young. And he basically feels that he can't quite support this weight of tradition. So he has this angst, this terrible idea that he's somehow not going to be good enough. So that's one thing. It accounts for the length of time he takes to write his first symphony. Then the second thing is sexual, that he effectively seems to fall in love with Clara Schumann, even though she's much, much older than he is. Remember, Brahms' mother was also much, much older than his father, very unusual at this time, and the reverse was very common, but very unusual. So this seems to affect Brahms' sexuality in both ways. He certainly idolizes Clara, maybe has an affair with Clara Schumann. All the letters have been destroyed, so we will never know. But we can speculate, as indeed I'm doing here. But they have a very intense relationship just at the time when Schumann goes mad, is incarcerated in an asylum, etc., etc. And one can almost say that no subsequent woman seems to have matched up to Clara Schumann in Brahms' eyes. So he has this terrible weight of expectation musically, and then this effectively sexually screwed up part as well.
How does, again, going along with that beard and the image of who he became at the end of his life in the 1890s, died in 1897, and also his own self-deprecation when he talks about the second piano concerto and says there's just a soupçon of a scherzo about that amazing volcanic, gigantic...
A tiny wisp of a concerto with a tiny, tiny wisp of a scherzo.
For a piece that lasts 50 minutes long. Yeah. So, you know, that self-deprecation maybe is part of all this too, but Stephen, is there a side then, this sensual, even sexual side to Brahms and his music that simply is there, but we just don't realise it, we don't talk about it much?
Well, we've got this image, haven't we, probably from rock music more than anything else, pop music, that somehow or other people writing exciting exploratory music are all having wild and wonderful sex lives. I mean, it often seems to me that most of the greatest and most sensually immediate music is born of intense frustration. It turns out now, a lot of scholars believe that Wagner's relationship with Mathilde Wesendonck was never actually sexually consummated. And it's actually easier to imagine that amazing volcanic piece, Tristan and Isolde, emerging out of frustration rather than out of actual fulfillment.
But Kenneth, I mean, do you feel that when you play Brahms music, that you have there's something in the finger, something in what Brahms asks you to do physically at the piano that is sensual, expressive in some way? Do you feel that frustration, that desire?
Very much. I mean, Brahms' piano writing, it's rather monodimensional in a way. It involves you digging into the piano, like a lover that you don't quite want to disappear, you know, this sort of thing. So there's this sort of... But, I mean, basically, there is no love like unrequited love in this sense, and this is what you get from Brahms, this sense of yearning. And we associate this with Wagner, as Stephen said, but in fact, it's all in Brahms, this sort of sense of what might have been. And it mirrors in his life. I mean, when he couldn't have Clara Schumann, he began to at one point think that he would marry her prettiest daughter, Yuli. And he seems to have fantasized about this, that maybe she was intended for him. And Clara seems to have thought there was never any question she was going to marry Brahms. So she announced one day to Brahms, oh, by the way, Yuli is going to marry this Italian nobleman. And Brahms was, for a short time, devastated. Yeah. So this all comes out in the music, there's no doubt about it.
Something else, Stephen, you talk about in that article for the Proms guys about the idea that Brahms might be a much, much more modern composer than we give him credit for, precisely because he does something which is very unusual for that time of the 19th century. He's involved in the editing, the promotion, really, of much earlier German music, 17th century music, 18th century music, Schütz and Bach. I mean, how modern is Brahms?
First of all, it's very difficult to appreciate for us to appreciate how very short, brief the musical past was for most people, music lovers in Brahms's time. Mm. Beethoven was the beginning of music for most people. Haydn was barely known. Mozart didn't enjoy anything like the status he enjoys today. And Bach was seen generally as a very eccentric interest. When you have Brahms looking at Heinrich Schütz or Palestrina, this was considered downright weird. But that idea that you can look to the past to find your way forward, which is something which, of course, is almost a commonplace in our time, is something that Brahms created probably more than anything else. The other thing is that it's very easy to identify Wagner's influence in music as the great progressive. The sound, the expressive language, the harmonic style, the orchestral colours and textures he created, plenty of echoes of those in music that followed. But Wagner's influence formally was actually rather small. Mm. And if you look at who was the most important intellectual influence on composers for generations after, particularly composers who wrote string quartets and symphonies and the forms that Brahms excelled in, it is overwhelmingly Brahms. Mm. Schoenberg probably owes more to Brahms than anybody else, you know, no matter what his inspiration
was. But was this, though, a crippling thing as well, this relationship with the past? We know that Brahms, what survives of Brahms' music, about 120 works, is probably about a third of what he wrote, because he burned or destroyed things he wasn't happy with. So two-thirds, potentially, of his music, of the music he wrote in his lifetime, he destroyed from that self-critical vein. I mean, was this whole sense of the weight of the past, I mean, was it something that released him, or was it something which actually pressured him into maybe an over-self-criticism?
I mean, it gave him ideas. I mean, almost every piece of Brahms, you can trace where the idea comes from. I mean, the Third Symphony, the initial idea seems to have come from a short passage in Schumann's Third Symphony. There's all sorts of biographical reasons for that that we could talk about later. So that the ideas come from the past and then they're worked in the present. So in that sense, they're inspiring. But I think what there also is with Brahms is this massive quality control. That composers can be divided into sort of two types of composers. I think one are those composers who just only publish those things that they think are extremely fine works. Chopin and Mendelssohn are two examples of this. Other composers are Handel, for example, just writes masses, and some of it's wonderful, some of it's actually just stolen directly from somebody else when he doesn't have time to do it, and other things are sort of all right. And so, or Liszt, who just produces hundreds and hundreds of works, some of which are wonderful and some of which are truly awful, you know. But I mean, Chopin and Brahms is this sort of thing. It's a really sort of very, it's like a sort of, you know, something where he simply has too much of a sense of self-consciousness to allow anything that he himself doesn't think is perfect to go through.
But isn't that because he sees himself so directly in what must have been a crippling self-consciousness, knowing that you're writing in a line, and uniquely he knew this, the relationship of all of his music to Schütz, to Bach, to Mozart, to Beethoven. I mean, so every time he takes a quill out and writes something down on a piece of manuscript paper, he's effectively comparing himself with the whole of music history. I mean, that would be terrifying.
You know, Tom, it's wonderful to get a question when you can just answer yes to
And yet, as we know, and as we've already touched on, pain, it can be enormously productive. Mm. And in Brahms's case, I think it was. Mm. And I was just looking the other day with a friend of mine who's learning the piano part for the first violin sonata, which is one of my absolute favorite Brahms pieces. Just the wonder of this thing that seems to be airborne in terms of its melodic inspiration for the entire 5-minute span of the first movement. And yet you can see this incredible meticulous calculation going on at every stage. How does he manage to be both? There are times when he comes close for me to Bach in that incredible synthesis of the intellectual emotion. There is no composer of Brahms's time who has such an amazing faculty for bringing form to feeling. That maybe was his greatest legacy.
But then why then do we have this, does this image persist of him then, as this greybeard writing sort of brown music? You know, Victorian drawing rooms, brown colours, that sort of thing. Mm. I wonder, both of you, if performance practice has something to do with this.
There's a sort of Teutonic way, a sort of modern Teutonic way of playing Brahms, which is just very boring, you know, yes. Slow, solid, sort of mezzo forte to forte. Brahms himself didn't play like that. I mean, the critics complained that Brahms spread almost every chord in slow movements. Mm. And Moritz Rosenthal, who heard him, said the same thing. In other words, he played a bit like Paderewski and you know, the Lechitsky people, this sort of rather. And the pianists he liked best were all pianists of the Liszt school. They were sort of people like Dalbert and this sort of thing.
The virtuosos,
yes. So, and he also apparently had what he called elastic tempo. So the tempo was very, very much a romantic style.
Yes. And the other thing is you hear or you play on the pianos of Brahms's time, and they just, the sound isn't as thick. Mm. You play one of those big, thick, thick lower chordal textures. And it's a different kind of sound. It's a different kind of articulation. Brahms loved the older instruments. He was a bit of a reactionary when it came to instrumental development in his own time. He specifically asked for the old unvalved horn in his marvellous horn trio.
Himself, wasn't he?
And he was a horn player himself. And I do think sometimes, you know, you look at those scores, you see the way he accents rhythms. He clearly wants something lighter on its feet than the way it tends to come over in modern orchestral performances.
Especially orchestral performances is the problem.
For example, the Meiningen Orchestra that Hans von Bülow conducts, it was a very unusual orchestra. Bülow was a slave driver. He rehearsed them incessantly. It was a small ensemble, utterly precise. They played standing up. From memory. The orchestra played standing up from memory. Not the cellist and double bass, of course, that would be asking too. I mean, they were like a military unit. So you just imagine...
That was new pieces too, wasn't it? So if they're learning a new Brahms symphony, you had to learn the whole thing.
And Bülow premieres some of the Brahms works. So there's this sort of enormous precision he wants, but yet Bülow is also somebody who believes in romantic flexibility and tempo rubato, etc., etc. But I think the final thing is that one of the reasons for Brahms' slightly grey reputation is the sort of music he writes. He doesn't write symphonic poems with big titles like My Exciting Day in the Alps or something like that. He doesn't write operas called The Sufferings of Young Werther or whatever, or Tristan und Isolde or The End of the World in the Ring. He writes something called String Quartet Number 1 or Symphony Number 3 and with no subtitles. And of course he does that because of the German tradition, because he hates Berlioz and Liszt, this idea of program music. He's anti, not so much personally anti-Werther, but he's pigeonholes anti-Wagner. He doesn't write an opera, so that's why he's grey in that sense.
But again, I wonder, is that just another beard-like mask and smoke screen? Stephen, you alluded to this. I mean, because the point is, he knew that this music was expressing something. You know, he wasn't just writing music to be part of this tradition. I mean, then does this music express? You know, if it's obvious and clear, we think what Wagner and Liszt meant, what does fundamentally Brahms' music express? You mentioned pain, Stephen, but
I do feel, and again, you know, one has to remember those very, very wise words of the philosopher Ernst Bloch, that when we talk about music, what we're really talking about is ourselves. And, you know, there is always, you know, one can only feel what one has the potential to feel in response to music. And yet, it does seem to me often, I mean, there is really quite strong evidence that Brahms had a serious depressive tendency. And wasn't it Eusebius Mandachevsky who said on one occasion, when Brahms is in particularly good spirits, he sings, "The grave is my joy." There are moments of almost heartbreaking sadness, and I don't know whether you've had the same experience, Ken, but I certainly have. You know, just playing some of those late piano pieces recently, and thinking, my God, this takes you to. In the second piano concerto, that extraordinary moment where it eventually the climax of the whole piece turns out to be in a hushed duet for clarinet and piano, almost as though you're taken out of the concert hall into the Lieder Salon, and someone is singing to you very intimately. These moments are of such intensity. Or the finale of the Fourth Symphony, where he revives an archaic practice nobody'd heard of called Passacaglia, and builds an entire movement in this very structured way, and doing so to create something mightily and magnificently tragic. The combination of that, in his best music, of that formal control with this incredible focused intensity of expression is like nobody else in his time.
Both of you, I feel you've both done more to reclaim Brahms in the last half an hour than generations of scholars. Ken Hamilton, Stephen Johnson, thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you, Tom.
Tom Service at the Royal College of Music earlier this evening with our Proms Plus intro, looking at Brahms, the man behind the music, which couldn't really be more appropriate given that he's at the heart of the concerts here in the Royal Albert Hall over the next couple of days. Well, welcome back from me, Martin Handley, to the second part of this All Brahms BBC Prom being given by the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, conducted by Bernard Haitink. Well, we've heard the symphony, now it's the concerto, Brahms' first for the piano, in which the soloist is Emmanuel Ax. But before we get back to the music itself, the COE celebrates its 30th birthday this year. Earlier today, I spoke to its chairman, Peter Redman, who's been involved right from the start.
The founder members of the group came together in May 1981 in London. We put on a concert, and that was the birth of the Chamber Orchestra of Europe. And as it happened, Claudio Bardo, who was a great friend of many of the musicians, said that, look, I'll come along if I can. And he was actually with the LSO at the time. He turned up on the hall, and James Judd, who was conducting it, just walked up the centre aisle and handed him the baton and said, over to you, to conduct the second half of the concert. So that was a fairly startling moment for everybody in the hall that night. Only 250-odd people. But nevertheless, that was the beginning. And the heart and the soul of COE has continued with 18 of the founder members who were sitting on the platform that night, still sitting in the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, and indeed on the platform here at the Proms in 2011, 30 years later. And of that 18, half of them have all married each other, and now we have an orchestra with somewhere close to 60 children as a result of marriages within the Chamber Orchestra of Europe. And if I just mention, as I looked this just this morning and stared at the rehearsal, I saw Marika leading. Well, Marika was a founder member of this orchestra and one of the ladies and girls. Actually, she was a teenager, as it happens, a late teenager, when I first met her in 1980 in Salzburg. She's leading the violins, as she has done now for over 25 years. Enno Senft, our principal bass, was leading the basses in May 1981, and Will Conway, the lead cello tonight at the Proms, was also leading the cellos in May 1981. So I just looked around the orchestra and sort of saw a sea of faces, all of whom I've known all my life.
Peter Edman. Well, Brahms was just 20 when his friend and mentor Schumann said of him, "I thought sooner or later someone would appear destined to give the ideal expression to the spirit of the times. His name is Johannes Brahms." So no pressure then. And it got even worse when Schumann died at just 46 and Brahms, who was half that age, was thrown into the centre of German musical life. He wasn't surprisingly hesitant about writing anything ambitious. The first piano concerto actually began life as a two-piano sonata, turned into a symphony before ending up in its final form. It took him about 5 years in all to complete what was, amazingly, given its complexity, length and maturity, his first important symphonic work. Its origins were directly to do with Schumann. The plunging theme of the first movement was Brahms' graphic attempt to come to terms with the day his friend tried to kill himself by throwing himself into the River Rhine, an event which marked the start of Schumann's final two-year illness. Brahms originally wrote the first words of the Benedictus above the opening of the elegiac slow movement. Could it have been intended as part of a requiem mass for Schumann? Well, perhaps, but later Brahms also told Schumann's wife, Clara, with whom he was in love, it was a portrait of her. But anyway, why shouldn't music be as complicated as life? The finale is serious, if not tragic, before the green shoots of hope lead to final triumph. Brahms' model, Schumann's piano concerto, which itself contained elements of Beethoven's third. Those two men being, of course, the composers in whose footsteps Brahms was most in awe of treading, Emmanuel Axe and Bernard Haitink, joining the Chamber Orchestra of Europe to perform Brahms' first piano concerto.
Thank you. Thank you.
triumphant end to Brahms' first piano concerto, one of his most deeply personal work, performed to end this BBC Prom in the Royal Albert Hall, live on Radio 3 by Emmanuel Axe. That big cheer for him with the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, led by Marika Blankenstein and conducted by Bernard Haitink. And at the end of that performance, Bernard Haitink just leant on the rail and looked at Manny Axe as if to say, there, that was something. Patted him on the shoulder, the two just looked at each other and grinned. The end of the first movement in rehearsal this morning, Bernard Haitink leant over and said, anything? As if, you know, and Manny Axe said, no, nothing. And there was also another lovely moment when the end of the first movement, the double basses, Bernard Haitink wasn't quite sure, and he said, was it all right? Well, maybe I wasn't right, but you were fine, with a great smile to the basses. And he's going off, shaking hands with the principals of all the string sections. They really commune with the music and with each other, this orchestra, this conductor, this soloist. And it's as though Manuel Axe is sort of feeling the orchestra's pulse and also demanding it, looking at them the way he does. Well, they're all off, apart from Manuel Axe, to Lucerne to do Brahms symphonies next week. Back comes Emmanuel Axe on his own. Bravo, hands clenched to the band as he comes to take his bow. Bernard Haitink, modest as always, leaving the limelight to Manny Axe. Well, 31 years ago, chairman of the orchestra, Peter Redman, was dragged away from his honeymoon to talk to members of the European Community Youth Orchestra, who wanted to stay together and form a new chamber orchestra. 18 of them are still here, including Marika Blankenstein, who's led the orchestra for 25 years. 15 different nationalities on the platform here tonight. Bernard Haitink may return in a moment, one hopes. He's off to Lucerne with the orchestra to finish the Brahms cycle. Got a bit of a holiday, but then Berlin, Chicago and New York, a very full autumn, he doesn't slow up much. Back they come together, absolutely together. Bernard Haitink with his arm around Manny Axe as they come. A huge applause from the orchestra, who adore Haitink, and getting them up. Well, if you're now in the Brahms groove, don't go anywhere, because he dominates the next 24 hours here in the Albert Hall, and of course on Radio 3. We're back at 10 tonight for the pianist Angela Hewitt in late Brahms intermezzos, before she's joined by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra and Andrew Manzi for neglected Schumann, when Brahms returns his G minor piano quartet as orchestrated by Schoenberg. And of course, tonight's magnificent combination of the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, Emmanuel Axe and Bernard Haitink, returns at 7:30 tomorrow evening for Brahms' second piano concerto and fourth symphony. Revelatory Brahms here on Radio 3, home of the BBC Proms. But for the next hour or so, let's relax back at base in Broadcasting House in the company of Jill Anderson.
Thanks very much. That was Martin Handley at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's Prom on Wednesday afternoon at 2 o'clock. That's here on Radio 3. Or you can listen to it whenever you want over the next 7 days via the BBC iPlayer. Well, our next programme is at 9:15, and it's the second part of North of South Revisited, a look at Tanzania after its years of colonial rule. So, to take us up to that, let's hear more music by Brahms, but this time for voices. Here are three motets, opus 110. They are Ich aber bin elend, Ich arme Welt, Ach arme Welt, and Wenn wir in höchsten Nöten sein. And they're sung by the Dresden Kreuzchor, conducted by Roderich Kreiler.
Thank you.
three motets by Brahms, Opus 110. They were sung by the Dresden Kreuzchor, conducted by Roderich Kreiler. Well, the pianist Angela Hewitt will be playing Brahms and Schumann in our next prom, and that starts at 10 o'clock. So let's hear her now playing Chopin. This is the Nocturne in G minor, Opus 37, number 1.
Thank you.
Angela Hewitt was playing Chopin's Nocturne in G minor, Opus 37, number 1. And she'll be playing in our prom, which you can hear live here on Radio 3 at 10 o'clock. She'll play two of the three intermezzos, Opus 117, and Schumann's Introduction and Concert Allegro. Also in the programme, Brahms arranged by Schoenberg, the Piano Quartet number 1, played by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Andrew Manzi. This is Radio 3. It's 9:15, and now we've another chance to hear the second part of North of South Revisited. The early 1960s were a heady time for Africa, as the wind of change swept through the continent, bringing self-governance and freedom from colonial rule to many countries. Nearly two decades later, the Trinidadian writer Shiva Naipaul travelled through East Africa to find what liberation meant to people then and how it had changed their lives. His book, North of South, has been described as one of the best travel books of all time and was required reading for anyone interested in Africa in the early 1980s. In tonight's programme, the Ugandan journalist Joel Kibazo retraces Naipaul's journey to see how much has changed. Tonight, he follows Naipaul to Tanzania, formerly Tanganyika, which celebrated Uhuru, or independence, in 1961.
I travel by bus from Mombasa to the Kenya-Tanzania border town of Taveta, a dusty, disordered collection of mud huts and wooden shacks roofed with corrugated iron. We crowded off the bus with our luggage and were shepherded into a small brick building housing immigration control.
The Trinidadian writer Shiva Naipaul was travelling through East Africa in the late 1970s. In his book, North or South, he reflects on the people he met on his journey and asks the question, what did liberation mean to people 20 years after independence?
How wide is the gap between the rhetoric of liberation and its day-to-day manifestations? How much cynicism is there? How much apathy? Do the people actually care? What are they like as individuals? Should we despair or should we continue to hope? Beyond all this, but not entirely unconnected with it, is the relationship of black and white and brown.
As Africa celebrates the 50th anniversary of 17 African nations this year, with others following shortly afterwards, I'll be revisiting those questions posed by Shiva Naipaul. As a Ugandan and a child of the independence era, I'm curious to find out how have things changed since Naipaul wrote North of South three decades ago.
The officer in charge ordered me to take off my hat, in deference, I suppose, to the portrait of Kenyatta hanging on the wall behind him. Do you have any Kenyan shillings on you? Show me your wallet. He extracted the 200 shillings, turned the wallet upside down and shook it vigorously. Satisfied that there was nothing more to be had, he returned the wallet, carefully folded the Kenyan notes and put them into his shirt pocket. I protested, but there was nothing I could do. I was aware that Kenyan currency was in great demand in Tanzania on the black market. We climbed back into the bus and set off for the Tanzanian post a few hundred yards further on. Once more, we crowded out of the bus with our luggage. The passengers, nearly all Tanzanian peasants, looked visibly tense as they carried their boxes, baskets, and cloth-wrapped bundles for inspection. It was clear that customs inspection on this side of the border was no mere ritual. Hat in hand, I went over to the customs officer. One corner of the platform was occupied by a small but growing pile of confiscated goods. With a small grunt of triumph, he fished out from my suitcase that half bottle of whiskey I was carrying. "And what is this?" "Whiskey." He revolved the bottle. "You cannot take this into Tanzania, Bwana. It is illegal to smuggle spirits into Tanzania." I wasn't smuggling. I gazed at him indignantly. "I do not make the law, Bwana," he shrugged. "I only do what the law says I must do." He handed the bottle to a minion who ostentatiously bore it off toward the pile of confiscated material.
In 1961, British ruled Tanganyika gained independence, followed in 1963 by the islands of Zanzibar. The two countries then united to form what is now modern Tanzania in January 1964. The first president, Julius Nyerere, had a socialist vision for the country.
Over the years, President Julius Nyerere of Tanzania has adopted something of the character and style that Nehru affected in the first years of Indian independence, claiming a special place in the moral firmament for himself, his policies, and by extension, his country.
It is the task of finding a common denominator which will guide us in our determination to rid our continent of the remaining vestiges of colonialism.
He is just about the only African head of state one can contemplate without immediate sensations of outrage or embarrassment. Here, astonishing as it may seem, is an African leader with pretensions to intellectual respectability. He has translated Shakespeare into Swahili. He makes it possible to believe, if only for a little while, that Africa can be taken seriously, that Africa wants to liberate itself.
I've come to the University of Dar es Salaam to meet one of Tanzania's most distinguished academics.
My name is Isai Shivji, and I was honored to be appointed to this Mwalimu Nyerere professorial chair in Pan-African Studies. As young people, we lived through that period, which was in Tanzania, as many other African countries, a period of intense nationalism.
Professor, Julius Nyerere had a vision for Tanzania of a socialist society. But by the time he had left the presidency, he acknowledged that perhaps that had been the wrong path for Tanzania. Do you agree with that?
He did not quite acknowledge that it was the wrong path. He did acknowledge there are some things that he would have not done. Although, of course, it proclaimed socialism, but if you look deeply into the Arusha Declaration, it was essentially a nationalist document. And Nyerere defined the task. First, the state has to develop. In other words, it's the agency for development, because we have no other agency in society which will develop the country. The state has to do it. For this country, he also had a unique vision of building a society of equals, which was socialism, self-reliance. It was a kind of vision which inspired people at the time. Thousands of people flooded the streets in support of the Arusha Declaration.
The declaration proclaims that the party is at war with poverty and oppression. Now we want a revolution, it declares, a revolution that brings to an end our weakness so that we are never again exploited, oppressed, or humiliated. Inherent in the Arusha Declaration is a commitment to the belief that there are more important things in life than the amassing of riches, and that if the pursuit of wealth clashes with things like human dignity and social equality, then the latter will be given priority.
What does independence mean to Tanzanians today, most of whom are under 30 and have no experience of colonialism or the heady days leading to independence?
Dar es Salaam began with the sprinkling of factories merging into dense suburbs of shanty-lined alleys. Overburdened buses of Romanian origin swayed and jolted along the potholed highway. Crowds of men shuffled along the dusty roadside heading towards the city. An even greater number squatted idly in the thick roadside dust. Lines of washing hung from the balconies of moss-blackened tenements. Everywhere, dust, neglect, decay. The unpainted facades of the buildings, the potholes, the unswept and crumbling pavements told of a city that was falling to pieces.
There is so much building. Look, that's a what? 10-story building. Next to it is Access Bank, again another skyscraper. But opposite it is the Village Museum, showing you what was the original idea of these villages that were to be constructed during the Ujamaa period. So while you may go to a 10-story bank building across the road, you're reminded of, in many ways, where Tanzania has come from in the last 30 years or so.
If you look at the pictures of 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, the landscape has changed dramatically. Dar es Salaam is like a construction site. Everywhere you go, you see constructions. Hospitals, schools, roads, bridges, new buildings are coming up.
I've come to the five-star Kilimanjaro Hotel to meet January Makambe, who's the special assistant to the president of Tanzania, His Excellency Jakaya Kikwete.
This hotel, the Kempinski itself, where we are, also is a big story about Tanzania. This used to be the Kilimanjaro Hotel, the one and the only five-star hotel back in the 70s, where important meetings regarding Africa's liberation and all these things took place. And then somehow in the 90s, it was run down, it was closed for a number of years, and the government looked for a buyer. And no one came up until an investor from the Middle East came in, bought it, refurbished it, and renamed it. But this hotel itself is a story of Tanzania as well.
30 years ago, when Shivanai Paul was traveling through Tanzania, things were very different.
Those days, actually, you're very right. I mean, it's quite tough. I'm only 36, but I'm old enough to remember living in a village with my grandmother, and we'll have to go to line up to buy sugar and soaps and all these other things that now we take for granted.
How do you think Tanzania was transformed from that era to now? What is it that brought about the change?
Well, I mean, obviously, 1985, when Nyerere left, and the new leadership thought that perhaps a different direction would be appropriate, welcoming free market liberalization of the economy, private shops allowed, and all those things. From then on, it has been an era of reforms in all sectors of a society to really open up the economy and allow private enterprise to really take the lead as the engine of the economy.
You're a young person in Tanzania. Can you see Tanzania going back to that kind of period?
No, that's absolutely... Of course, I would not want to, but I think it's impractical. 70% of Tanzanians are under 30, so it's quite a young nation, and that has political and social significance.
On the umbrella-shaded terrace of the New Africa Hotel, people were having breakfast and reading newspapers. It looked promising. The reception clerk took a long time making up his mind as to whether or not he could offer me a room. I was surprised that the hotel was so full, being well aware that Tanzania's tourist trade was languishing. He concluded that he could offer me a room, but I would, he warned, have to wait until the room was cleaned, an operation that could take 1 hour, 2 hours, or even 3 hours.
This is the New Africa Hotel, which has been in Dar es Salaam for many, many years. And this is where Shivanai Paul came and stayed and had such appalling service. He was completely put out and disgusted by the kind of service levels that there were in Tanzania.
I bought a newspaper and went out to the terrace. My waiter was strolling nonchalantly among the tables. I called him over. What's happened to my breakfast? It's coming.
When?
15 minutes later, he returned. It will soon be ready. The cook forgot. My breakfast arrived. I noticed there was no butter and asked for some. Butter you cannot have.
Why not?
Because there is none. The coffee I poured into my cup turned out to be tea. Is anything wrong, Bwana? The waiter looked at me worriedly. Everything is fine, just fine. Since you are satisfied with my service, you will give me a nice tip?
Tipping is illegal in Tanzania. Do you want me to break the law?
He giggled. I think you are a capitalist, Rhoda.
I handed him a 100-shilling bill.
I want all my change back.
15 minutes later he returned, the bill intact.
Change you cannot have. The cashier has not yet been to the bank.
We've come to the Bandari restaurant at the New Africa Hotel to actually have a power lunch advertised in one of the local magazines, and it says, since the best deals often happen not in a boardroom, but over lunch, work out a perfect deal over a perfect luncheon at the Bandari Grill as you iron out those finer details. But when you turn to the actual menu, it's a sort of actually standard fare menu with steaks and soups. I mean, fish and chips, tandoori king fish, Greek salads, then spaghetti Napolitano. So basically, something for everybody other than the Tanzanian, of course, who I'm sure would not be coming here to eat local food.
I went to see if my room was ready. It was not. How much longer do I have to wait? That is difficult to say, the clerk replied. The cleaners, he said, were attending a meeting. They are making big protests about the racist Rhodesian fascists. After about an hour, I was summoned by the clerk. A little problem has arisen, he said. The cleaners cannot get into the room to clean it. He smiled affably at me. I remained calm. Why is that? The keys have been lost, he laughed heartily. I also have some good news for you. I have discovered there is another room we can give you. But I have to wait until it has been cleaned? His laughter swelled. No, it has already been cleaned. You can move in straight away. I sat on the bed and collected myself before calling the reception desk. What kind of hotel is this? This is five-star hotel-y. The bed in my room was unmade. I'll send somebody to make it for you. The towels weren't clean. I'll send someone with clean towels. The hot water doesn't work. A short silence at the other end. Then, nobody has ever complained about the hot water before. Mr. Hankel, a management expert, had been sent out to Tanzania by the United Nations. Mrs. Hankel, after 3 months in Arusha, was close to breakdown. Listen, she said, it's driving me crazy. I can't get butter, can't get milk, I can't get cheese, I can't get frankfurters. What do people here live on? I knew what she meant. The shelves of the shops were bare.
I was standing in the middle of huge freezer cabinets that have just about every frozen food you can imagine, from fish to meat to smoked bacon. In Shiva Naipaul's time when he was writing, it was the scarcity he talks about in a country that's an agriculture country, the scarcity of goods, the scarcity of shops, and really how the system had collapsed and failed. What you now have is a complete contrast of what they tried to do away with, which is capitalism. And what has it delivered? Abundance. You can have just about anything. But yes, poverty remains. Nobody's pretending that every Tanzanian can come to this supermarket. The other thing you notice in a supermarket such as this is the growing influence of South Africa. This was a country that was once considered one of the frontline states in the fight against apartheid. So the irony of me standing in ShopRite, a South African supermarket chain full of South African goods, I still find incredible, because in my lifetime I had a stamp in my passport that said anywhere but South Africa, and Tanzania was very much at the forefront of that fight against South Africa, as South Africa then was.
How are you?
Keeping well?
Good, you're good.
Okay. Back.
My name is Donald Shana, Managing Director of Garden Limited. I remember we met in...
We met in Kampala.
Several times.
In Kampala
Ghana.
And in Ghana. I was just saying, how can you contrast somebody like yourself when you tried to go to a shop in 1978? Compare
it's
that
very
to...
Different, very different, because it was the time when we can hardly buy soaps from the shops. Now everything is here, and you can get everything in the shops.
Yeah. So basically, life is much better.
Much better.
So was Nyerere wrong?
I don't think that he was... I'm not saying that he was wrong, but I think he was misled. The system now is good. Nyerere was misled.
Over there, the noise that's coming is a Coca-Cola promotion. In the 1970s, Coca-Cola was seen as the sort of enemy of development, especially here in Tanzania. The rapper is talking about the various presidents and extolling the virtues of Tanzania. But, you know, it's rap music being blasted out at a Coca-Cola stand while actually paying homage to socialism. So the ironies abound. It's wonderful. This, in many ways, epitomizes the new Africa, where consumption is fine. And yes, there is poverty, but people, young people, and those that have made it, there's no fear in showing your wealth and how well you're doing, and actually consuming those goods that were once the preserve only of Western countries. What it actually also has done is that it reduces the gap between African societies and Western societies. And the other thing that has done that is the growth of international broadcasting, because we watch similar television programs. Television has meant that the gap has really narrowed between the West and Africa.
The road out of town was in a truly terrible state. We swerved crazily from verge to verge, dodging the potholes, some of which were the size of small craters. The road looked as if it had been pounded by murderous artillery.
One of the things you see that has changed in Dar es Salaam and Tanzania as a whole, actually, is the greatly improved roads compared to when Shiva Naipaul was traveling around the country. The downside is that the traffic is so incredible that although the roads are smoother and better, you can't get through them that quickly because of the sheer volume of traffic. Now, in some ways, that is good because it means that the economy has grown. People are earning a lot more and are able to buy a car. In those times, it was just a phenomenal thing to be able to afford to buy a car, so there wasn't very many on the roads.
There are no classes in the sophisticated Marxist sense in Tanzania, only peasants, party officials, and aid workers. Class struggle, since it does not exist, has to be invented. Marxism, like Christianity before it, has been reduced to a caricature in Africa.
I've come here to Kawe Beach in the north of Dar es Salaam, where I've come to meet Adam Lesekelo, who in many ways has seen Tanzania right through the independence period, having been born just before, and his father was involved in the first government of Julius Nyerere, the then leader of Tanzania. Adam, socialism has been dropped. What do you have now?
I think we have confusion, if you ask me. We went full speed to capitalism, and there's no capital. It's a mixed economy, but you see, it's a confused economy. The biggest worry here is that we're creating classes. We've got a class of very rich people and a class of very poor people. And these classes are growing, and we're going to have a clash sooner or later.
What would you say is the place of Tanzania today? Is it a success? Has it been a failure? Or is it both?
Both. It has been a failure. We still are fumbling on what to do with the economy. We haven't empowered our people. And it's a success in that we are not machine gunning each other. Nyerere forged a nation. I'm very proud of being a Tanzanian. I'm a Tanzanian full stop.
Here at Slipway on a Sunday evening, people have come to eat, drink, and look at shops full of designer goods. It's a real mixture of Tanzanians of African, Asian, and Arabic origin, and there are even Europeans and Chinese people too, all mingling happily. There are children playing and running around, while women covered head to toe in black burqas walk past scantily clad young women without batting an eyelid. Everyone seems to have a mobile phone, while quite a few are taking advantage of the free Wi-Fi to check their emails on their laptops. while it seems to vindicate Nyerere's dream of a peaceful and united nation, I wonder what he would have made of the distance Tanzania has travelled from his dream of a socialist revolution.
We drove past a compound filled with scores of Chinese trucks used during the building of the Great Uhuru Railway. This railroad, built by the Chinese, links the Zambian copper belt with the port of Dar es Salaam. "The Chinese are our best friends," remarked Abdullah. "Despite the machinations of the imperialists, we have made a great deal of progress in Tanzania." The pat phrases, unleavened by thought, came pouring out of Abdullah's mouth. Did Abdullah really understand the nonsense he spouted?
We've come to a national trade fair in Dar es Salaam, being held on a Saturday, and there's streams of people. It's an indication of the way Tanzania has embraced the world of business and trade. You wouldn't have expected to see something like this, say, 20, 30 years ago, where with international companies competing at a show like this. So you have a European company in Volvo competing against a Korean company in Hyundai with a various product. But it shows you how much these companies are putting into actually trying to woo buyers and to win business in a place such as Tanzania. This poster has Uhuru on it. Very different to what it meant at independence. Uhuru meant liberation in terms of political liberation from Britain, the colonial master. Now it seems to be used in a commercial sense, freedom to buy and sell anything that you want. In this particular case, freedom to have a mobile phone that can roam anywhere in the world. And so it seems as if the old slogan has been adopted for the very new Tanzania that we are in today. The competition between mobile phone companies is just amazing. That one says free calls for 90 days. Ah, but this one says 50% off. This one is highlighting its internet services that you can get on its phones. Africa is perhaps the fastest growing market for mobile telephony. When I first started as a reporter covering the African mobile telephone company some 15 years ago, many said there isn't really going to be a market for mobile telephony because Africans are too poor. And yet we see that this now is the playground for some of the biggest companies, including Bharti from India, Vodafone from the UK, and Orange from France. This now is the playground to try and get a slice of that burgeoning market.
For days, the newspaper and radio had been full of the impending eclipse of the sun. One writer even suggested that it should be interpreted as a triumph for socialism. The fact that the sun was about to go out over Tanzania was a portent of supreme revolutionary significance. Shortly before 7 o'clock, as though a cloud had suddenly passed over the face of the sun, the bright morning light suddenly dimmed. The air seemed peculiarly still. A dog howled. It was like a signal. The shadow began to shrink. Gradual color and life returned to the world. The tropical morning reasserted itself.
I'm having lunch with a friend of mine, Richard Ngamba, of the IPP Media Group, where he is a journalist. The media scene has changed in Tanzania over the last 15, 20 years. How would you characterize those changes?
You remember in 1990s, we were also forced to introduce multi-party system as part of the expansion of democracy. And to have that, the country was also forced to liberalize the media sector. Previously, the media was controlled by the state and the ruling party. So from 1990, we started seeing the explosion of the independent media.
And are you completely free as a journalist in Tanzania these days?
The problem we have right now is not about the freedom. It's about the quality of the content that you produce, are they holding the state accountable where the state has gone wrong, or are they really serving the public interest, or we are just serving the ruling cliques or the politicians who always manipulate the editorial? The biggest revenue comes from the advertisement. The number one advertiser is the government. So what they are doing right now, if you hammer them, they will drain your revenue. They cut down advertisement. This is what we are experiencing right now.
But have you found any particular stories that you cannot report? For instance, corruption is something that has been talked about right across Africa. And here in Tanzania, I mean, there's been some really big stories in Tanzania, including senior officials having to resign. So have you been able to hold the government to account?
We have been able to report about it. Corruption is not just about resignation and being condemned. If you have resigned, we need to see legal action being taken.
Do you see a future for Tanzania?
Yeah, I see a future, because we got our independence in 1961 with one lecturer, one medical doctor qualified, two professors. Today, when you look back, we have done something. My only disappointment with Tanzania and Africa in general is we are not ready to take responsibility for our failure. We are blaming colonialism for everything. We are blaming donors for everything. But we forget one thing. In 1961, Malaysia, Ghana, South Korea, Tanzania were at par in terms of the economic performance. Tanzania and Ghana, we are sinking deep, and we are still blaming the same colonialism. We have to take responsibility that we failed after 50 years of independence. Now, what's the way forward?
Do you know the way forward?
First, Africa is not poor. Africa is broke. And Africa is broke because of mismanagement of resources and poor leadership. We need committed leaders who knows that I have 5 years to deliver. Failure to that, I'll be out.
The publications of the house were neatly arrayed on the shelves lining the walls of the room. Class Struggles in Tanzania by Isa Shivji promised to discuss the emergence of contradictions between workers and the peasants, and the decline of the Asian-dominated commercial bourgeoisie, including several famous cases of manager lockouts and factory takeovers.
When Naipaul was travelling around Dar es Salaam, who went into the bookshop of the publishing house, and of course all he could see was books extolling the virtues of socialism, a bookshop today in Dar es Salaam looks very different. What you have here is a lot of management and self-help books, including management accounting, fundamentals of human resource management, software engineering. So in other words, books that will help you improve your life, which is the new ethos, I think, that is very much being pushed.
Comrade Shivji also surfaced in another publication, The Silent Class Struggle, in which is examined the restructuring of the social behavior and attitudes of a hitherto oppressed, dominated people.
A person like Shiva Naipaul, whose observations are extremely superficial, who hardly understood Tanzania, let alone, he did not understand Africa at all. Whatever one may say about independence in Africa, we should not forget one thing. That is one continent with 5 centuries of plunder and exploitation, 2 centuries of which there was slave trade, and a century of colonialism. No other continent has gone through that. So when independence came, the continent was left in total shadows. And that's a continent that was inherited by nationalized leaders.
Professor Shivji, just behind your chair, sitting here in your office, there's a wonderful quote on the wall which says, for a Tanzanian leader, he must be forbidden to be arrogant, extravagant, contemptuous, and oppressive. Is that how you see the current leadership?
Yes, because these days there is a lot of talk about good governance. The Arusha Declaration never talked about good governance. It talked about good leadership. And for me, there's a big difference. And that quotation is about who is a good leader. And just above that, there is a quotation from the Arusha Declaration of what was the vision.
I mean, the quotation above that says, we have been oppressed a great deal, we have been exploited a great deal, now we must have a revolution which brings to an end our weaknesses so that we are never again exploited, oppressed, or humiliated. Do you think Tanzania is now being exploited, oppressed, and humiliated?
And particularly humiliated, yes. when you cannot make your own decisions. And there cannot be a greater humiliation than that.
But who's making the decisions? You've got a leadership, you've got a president, you've got a party, you've got who's making those decisions?
You've got all the paraphernalia. And don't forget, in many cases, of course, these aren't the policies which were required to be adopted by the IMF, the World Bank, and the so-called donor community. Because the government no longer set their own priorities. Now, that has what has been taken away from the African states. These things are dictated to them.
I've now crossed over to the Department of History to meet Natasha Shibji, who's an assistant lecturer in the department. Natasha, my first question has to be, is it in the mandates of this university that there must always be a Shibji?
No, of course not.
All right. I've been going around Tanzania and revisiting some of the places that Shivanaipaul would have seen on his journey 30 years ago. It's a very different Tanzania that you have from 30 years ago. You as a young person now, did you know about some of the things it talks about, the way everybody believed in socialism, but yet it seemed to provide nothing?
Of course, it didn't touch me in the same way as it did to people who are in their adult ages living through it. But I have heard a great deal from what happened then, and of course today it affects us in that we don't want to go back there. However, from what I've read and what I've heard, I do feel that Nyerere's socialism brought about a sense of hope, a sense of anticipation for something better, that lingering faith that something could come out of our struggles for independence. Whereas today we've even lost that faith that something can happen. We simply live in the day-to-day life. So while our shops may be full, you really have a large discrepancy between the rich and the poor, and those who are benefiting from capitalism today and the liberalization policy starting in the 80s are really, again, the urban elite.
But the mantra seems to be foreign investment that will create jobs, that will help our countries out of the poverty that still exists. So are you saying that is wrong?
Wrong? It hasn't worked. Foreign investment has not done anything for the peasants living in the worst conditions possible.
Outside in the bright sunshine, women wrapped in colorful clothes queued patiently, waiting to have their babies weighed by the Swedish volunteer. There were flies everywhere, settling around the eyes of the children and their mothers, feeding greedily on sores, spreading the infections which the clinics sought to combat. I watched the Swedish girl weighing the babies. Roughly half were below the recommended minimum weight for their age. The mothers of these starvelings were doled out rations of cooking oil, soy flour and cornmeal, gifts, as the cans and boxes and sacks in the storeroom proclaimed, of the people of the United States of America.
My question is simply this. Is capitalism a real alternative for Africa today?
And do you think that socialism is the answer?
I'm saying something like socialism, call it whatever you may, but not capitalism that we have seen, which is causing devastation in this country, in Africa. The plunder that is going on is the kind of plunder that you had during the colonial era.
It's a warehouse of cheap Chinese goods, from the most gaudy painted pictures to just about everything, from plastic toys to children's clothing, handbags. Where are you from?
China, yeah.
Which part of China?
Harbin.
And what is it that you're selling here?
Bedsheet and watches.
How do you find doing business in Africa?
No problem, good.
Yeah, all right. Okay, thank you very much. I think you've got a customer. So you better go.
Tanzania cites the Chinese experience as the ultimate justification for revolutionary fervor. But what works in China, all too patently, does not work in Tanzania. Why? Because the Chinese experience has no relevance to anyone but the Chinese and the people of similar cultural background. Of all the misconceptions and delusions underlying the Tanzanian socialist revolution, this perhaps is the greatest. That the Chinese experience can be utilized by the Tanzanians. Nothing could be further from the truth.
To me, China is not the good partner. It used to be in the 70s when the U.S.